Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Parliament once again comes face to face with Michael Zahaf-Bibeau. The disturbing video he recorded just before the Ottawa terror attack has now been released. In it, he names the Prime Minister, speaks of his religious beliefs, and says the attack is retaliation for the missions in Afghanistan and Iraq. In addition to this, police believe others may have been involved.
We'll break down the video, give you the latest on the RCMP investigation, and we'll speak with Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney about how this will impact the government's new anti-terror legislation.
McLean's hosted two major forums this week. We went down to Washington, D.C. to discuss the Keystone XL pipeline, while the other panel was on women in politics here in Ottawa. The host of QP Live on McLean's.ca, Nick Taylor-Vasey, walks us through the highlights of both discussions.
This weekend, conservatives are getting together for the 7th annual Manning Networking Conference. It has been described as the Woodstock for right-leaning politicos. We speak with the founder of the Manning Center, former Reform Party leader Preston Manning, about the state of conservatism in Canada today.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
I don't know. There's a bunch of gunshots.
I saw him coming.
That was the sound on October 22nd when Michael Zahaf-Bibeau stormed onto Parliament Hill and began opening fire not long after killing Corporal Nathan Cirillo at the National War Memorial. In the days after the attack, it was revealed that before the first shots were fired, Zahaf-Bibeau recorded a video on his cell phone explaining why he was about to commit this horrific crime. Well, this week, almost 4.5 months later, the RCMP commissioner finally released the recording publicly during a special meeting of the Public Safety Committee.
Zahaf-Bibeau recorded the video alone in his car. He speaks quickly yet calmly, and his eyes keep darting around, looking in many different directions as he speaks. Due to the ongoing investigation, police did edit out 18 seconds from the video, but they wouldn't explain what material was cut or why it needed to be pulled. Before we continue, we will play the full recording that was released by the RCMP. It is just less than a minute long, and the audio is poor, but we'll break it down for you once it is done.
For those who are involved and listen to this movie, this has been a retaliation for Afghanistan, and because Harper wants to send troops to Iraq, so we are retaliating. The Mujahideen of this world, Canada, has officially become one of our enemies by fighting and bombing us and creating a lot of terror in our country and killing us and killing our innocents. So just aiming to hit some soldiers just to show you that you're not even safe in your own land. You got to be careful. So may Allah accept from us. It's a disgrace. You guys have forgotten God and have you let every indecency and things run in your land. We don't go for this. We are good people, righteous people, believers of God, and believe in His laws and His prophets, peace be upon them all. So that's my message to all of you. And this, inshallah, will not cease till you guys decide to be a peaceful country and stay to your own and stop going to other countries and stop occupying and killing the righteous of us who are trying to bring back religious law in our countries. Thank you.
So Zahaf-Bibeau begins by saying his attack is in retaliation for the mission in Afghanistan and because Harper wants to send his troops to Iraq. So he specifically mentions the Prime Minister. Now Zahaf-Bibeau then says he is a part of the Mujahideen of this world and Canada is an official enemy. He says he is just aiming to hit soldiers to show that we're not safe in our own land. He also speaks a lot about his religion, says it's a disgrace Canadians have forgotten God, and asks Allah for acceptance for his actions.
The committee didn't just discuss the video. There was also an update on the investigation into the attack. RCMP Commissioner Bob Paulson gave some disturbing new details, saying he believes Zahaf-Bibeau was influenced by others.
We are actively investigating individuals who may have contributed to his crimes.
But Paulson wouldn't say how close police are to tracking these people down. Here's a montage of clips from the RCMP commissioner on the other findings from the investigation, which he shared during his testimony.
Through our inset structure, the RCMP has over 130 full-time investigators and staff presently working on this case. We've interviewed over 400 individuals, from the people he associated with in British Columbia, to the people he rode the Greyhound bus with, to the people who saw him at the shelter in Ottawa. We know now that Zahaf-Bibeau became increasingly aligned with terrorist ideology in the last years of his life while living in the lower mainland of British Columbia and, for a short period, in Alberta. Beginning on September 23rd and continuing to October 2nd, Zihaf Bibeau made his way to Ottawa by hitchhiking and traveling on a Greyhound bus. On the days leading up to October 22nd, Zihaf Bibeau made arrangements to buy a car. On October 21st, he finalized the deal and used cash to purchase the vehicle. Upon taking possession, he drove to Mont-Tremblant to visit a relative where he was seen with a long knife. Very early the next morning, October 22nd, he was observed by witnesses placing a rifle in the trunk of his car. Hours later, he shot and killed Corporal Cirillo, got back in his car, and then stormed Parliament. I've shared with you his approach to this building. We have not been able to confirm the origins of the gun. We are releasing a photo of the gun, which seems unique, in the hopes that someone might recognize it. I can confirm that he had a long knife tied to his wrist when he was killed. We did not find any other guns or weapons in his car, among his possessions, or at any of the other locations we now know he visited in the hours leading up to the attack. I can confirm that the autopsy report or the toxicology screen on Zihaf Bibeau's remains was negative for drugs and alcohol. Neither did we uncover any evidence of drug or alcohol use by him in the period leading up to his attack. It was during the search of his vehicle following the attack that we found Zihaf Bibeau's mobile phone. Our forensic analysis, which began immediately and progressed quickly, revealed the video. Initially, I was inclined to release the video in its entirety, but I was persuaded by the operational decision makers in the investigation not to do so. I am satisfied that there are reasonable and sound operational reasons for these edits, and you will no doubt want to understand these reasons too. Unfortunately, for the very same reasons we have edited the video, I cannot explain to you at this point why we have done so. Let me also say that if Zihaf Bibeau had not been killed, but rather taken into custody, we would have charged him with terrorist offenses. The RCMP believes on the evidence that Zihaf Bibeau was a terrorist.
Now, the release of this video comes just days before this same committee will start reviewing Bill C-51, the government's new controversial anti-terror legislation. Under questioning from the New Democrats, Commissioner Paulson admitted the current laws would have been adequate to arrest and charge Zihaf Bibeau with terrorism, and nothing under the current laws would have impeded the investigation. That was an important moment for the NDP since it had been arguing the changes are unnecessary. To speak more about the video and Bill C-51, I'm joined now by Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney. So, Minister Blaney, thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Mac.
You were there on Parliament Hill that tragic day. What was your personal reaction when you saw the video after it was released?
I must tell you, it brought back, actually, and I didn't realize until I had fully envisioned it, but it brought back those very difficult and dark hours where we would not know where exactly what was happening and what our faith would be. So I must tell you, I was disturbed, emotionally impacted by the by seeing that this individual is so cold-blooded and premeditated and so, resolve in his Machiavellist plan, that it brought back a moment where I thought I would not make it.
How did it make you feel seeing how calm Zihaf Bibeau was shortly before he went to the National War Memorial and shot and killed Corporal Nathan Cirillo?
It's frightening, and I would say disgusting, to see that an individual would be willing to harm and kill other fellow Canadians in such a cold-blooded approach. I'm just shattered to see that this individual was so radicalized that he was acting on a premeditated act that I feel sorrow. Frankly, I feel sorrow for the family of the fallen. I've had the privilege to meet personally the twin sister of a warrant officer, Patrice Vincent, and to see this degree of not sensitivity, of being so dehumanized. I felt this individual was dehumanized, and this is what is shocking in that video, to see that someone can be so brainwashed by those extremist ideology that he can turn into an evil person. This is really frightening, and certainly is a great motivation to take reasonable action to prevent those individuals from harming other Canadians.
So, do you think this video sort of shuts the door on the suggestion that's being made from the opposition that this was just a lone wolf attack by a man with mental health and drug problems?
Well, this is right, Cormac. This video is clearly demonstrating that this is a terrorist attack. And unfortunately, there are still some politicians who are pretending, for whatever for reason I can hardly understand. Now it's crystal clear this individual knew what he was doing, and he attacked other fellow Canadians. This was a terrorist attack, and we need to acknowledge the fact, so if we want to be able to bring forward a solution to this challenge we are facing, that are those radicalized Canadians that are being brainwashed by this extremist ideology, in this particular case, the international jihadi.
What do you make of the fact that Zahaf Babo, in his video, specifically mentions the prime minister? He says Harper wants to send his troops to Iraq. What do you make of that?
The matter of the fact is we've been engaged in fighting terrorism long before Prime Minister Harper was the prime minister of this country, and long even before it began. It goes back to the attack of September the 11th, and we were engaged against ISIL before we sent airstrikes. So I think... you can disagree with the prime minister of the country or a political party, but this is never be and shall never be an excuse to commit violence here or abroad. That's what it is.
So this video has been released just before the Public Safety Committee looks at Bill C-51, the new anti-terror legislation. Your government has used the Ottawa terror attack to justify why this bill is needed. But can you name a single measure that actually would have prevented this attack by Michael Zahaf Bibeau?
Yes, there are three measures that clearly would have had a positive impact, although it's hard to predict what would be the result of our bill, which is aimed at preventing further future potential attack and actually preventing them from happening. How we can prevent attack from happening? By shutting down the website and being able to reduce the threat by allowing our intelligence officer to intervene before a radicalization happens. So in the case of Mr. Couture, who did the attack on the October the 20th, we could have, by lowering the threshold, Commissioner Polson was really clear this afternoon that a whole month was lost in the judicial procedures, whereas if we are to lower the threshold, we will increase the capacity of police officer to make preventative arrests and prevent terrorist attack, or just as the two allegedly girls who left Montreal a week ago, it was reported that they left the country to travel for terrorist purpose, we could be able to prevent them from boarding on an airplane.
But, I mean, with preventative arrests, people didn't know about Michael Zahaf Bibeau. It doesn't appear that he may not have been radicalized by the internet. So that's unclear at this point. And no one had reported him, so there wouldn't have been the possibility of intervention. So I think some of the issue that's being raised by the opposition is that you're using an event to justify changes. Even if those changes were in place, they wouldn't have prevented the event that you're using to justify those changes.
Listen, the decision to release the video was done by the RCMP, and for operational reasons, they decided that they would shorten the video. What is clear is that the first terrorist was under the scrutiny of the intelligence, but they were not able to reduce the threat. What I'm saying is if we have a better information sharing of Canadian willing to travel for terrorist purposes, we can better prevent them from committing terrorist attacks. This bill is not aimed to rewrite history. This bill is aimed at preventing further terrorist attack. And nobody can now say that this was not a terrorist attack. And the tools we are providing are practical tools that are reasonable and balanced, that, and that also have, and I know maybe you want to raise it, but that have check and balances toward judicial oversight and review as well, and respecting the privacy of Canadians. So that's what we're proposing. That's why I feel so important that this bill, more than ever, be clearly explained to Canadians for what it is, and that's what I intend to do next Tuesday at committee.
The last thing I just want to ask you about, one of the sections of Bill C-51 would actually make it illegal to promote terrorism, but this week your party put out an ad over the internet that basically retransmits still in a quote from an actual terrorist propaganda video where they made threats to the West Edmonton Mall. Some lawyers are suggesting that that could have possibly have broken your own proposed law.
Those attacks are ridiculous because, as you know, the criminal code is taking into account the context. And what is really important now for Canadians, what Canadians are asking me is how come you have not put those measures in place? So when we are giving example of a terrorist, this is obviously not promoting terrorism. And that's what I would have to say to that, Cormac.
But even some of your own conservative MPs and a provincial progressive conservative MLA say that it went too far. One of them said it's divisive politics, is trying to capitalize on fear.
Well, actually, indeed, I think it's important more than ever to show that we will not be intimidated and to show that we trust. I think it's now time to trust our police officer, to trust our security intelligence officer, and to trust our justice system, and to show that we actually, I think it's a great, it's an opportunity to show how proud we are to be Canadian and how we want to defend those values. And the C-51 is actually accomplishing that. It's reinforcing all. Not only it's reinforcing the judicial mechanism we have to protect the right and the freedom of Canadian, as well as it is enlarging, it is expanding the capability for CSIS to reduce the threat and allowing our police officer to intervene in a more efficient manner.
But could you not see how, from the Canadians' point of view, it's a little confusing where on one day you came out and said, you know, they should go shopping and they shouldn't be afraid, and then the next day your party, well, not the next day, but days later, your party puts out a piece quoting the threat against the mall and against Canadians and saying, look at this, sign the petition. So it seems like it's coming from two sides here.
Well, the thing is that we have to face reality for what it is. We are faced with a terrorist international jihadi threat. And if we want to come up with solution and efficient tool to tackle terrorists, track them, and being able to increase our measures to prevent radicalization and increase the pillar of our strategy, we need to face to be able to face the reality and share information relative to that threat. That's why I would say again that I encourage Canadians to show resilience, to show that we are resolved as a country and we are united and we will fight this terrorist threat and we won't be intimidated. And of course, unfortunately, we've seen in the video today, there are people who have evil means. So that's what I would say, Cormac.
That was Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney discussing the video from Michael Zahaf-Bibeau and his new anti-terror legislation.
Still to come on the show, we have two major McLean's forums, one in Washington discussing the Keystone Pipeline and the other in Ottawa on women in politics. And we speak with Preston Manning about the state of conservatism in Canada.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we're joined by Preston Manning, the former leader of the Reform Party and the founder of the Manning Center. But first,
Maclean's held two major forums this week in the U.S. and Canadian capitals. One brought us stateside to discuss relations around the Keystone XL pipeline, and the other was here in Ottawa to take a look at women in politics. Nick Taylor-Vasey, the host of QP Live on Macleans.ca, walks us through the highlights.
Maclean's and CPAC went to Washington, D.C. on March 3rd to talk about Canada-U.S. relations beyond the six-year struggle over the Keystone XL pipeline. We convened a bi-national panel at the museum, just a few blocks down Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House. And no matter how far the conversation strayed from the pipeline's ultimate fate, it always seemed to circle back. Even a presidential veto hasn't pushed the affable Gary Doer, Canada's man in Washington, from his stridently pro-Keystone rhetoric. Doer insisted repeatedly that a pipeline from Alberta is safer than any alternative.
And it's not just a, quote, foreign government. As I say, it takes that much time. Even in Canada, the empire has no grid, a national grid. You know, all the transmission lines go north and south. On the pipeline, the State Department said, and they've been correct, that if the pipeline is not built, the oil will come down on rail. They made that prediction 3 years ago. They made it again last year, and they've been right. There's a million barrels a day extra oil since Barack Obama has been president. More than any other president, it has come from Canada to the United States. It's just getting there in the wrong way without building a pipeline, in my view. The State Department said that if it's not built, it'll be coming down on rail, and rail has higher emissions, higher safety risks. They actually reported 28 deaths. They released that on a Friday afternoon. Very few people reported that. And a higher cost. When you look at those three liabilities, one of them is to Canada, the cost. The second safety issue is to the Americans. They just had a horrific accident in West Virginia. That oil went through Chicago. And the third issue is higher emissions. So if the president says no, because people say you stop the pipeline, you save the planet, you're actually having higher emissions. So yes, it's bad for Canada, but I would argue strongly that the United States is taking two of the three liabilities by saying no. Now, that's their right to do that, or the president's right. But, you know, we have over 63 votes in the Senate and 61% of the House, including my good friend, voting for that pipeline.
The only panelist who opposed Keystone was Danielle Droitsch, the Canada Project Director at the D.C.-based Natural Resources Defense Council. She had an answer for Doer, and she had lots of answers, actually. The pair might have agreed that railways can be a dangerous way to carry oil, but she disagreed completely that Keystone would remove any oil from North American tracks.
Well, I mean, I would agree with the congressman about the likelihood on Keystone perhaps being rejected. And the reason for that is not political. I think that there has been a strong case made against the pipeline on a number of issues. And that includes the climate impacts. What we've learned, what Americans have learned, is that tar sands, oil sands, when it spills, it actually sinks in water and has... doesn't act like conventional oil. And because of that, as Americans have come to learn more and more about this heavy oil, which is the number one source of oil to the United States, foreign oil to the United States, that it is not in keeping with the type of energy where we want to go. It has risk to water, has risk to the climate. And I disagree with the ambassador on the rail issue. There has been an argument made, which we don't accept, that it is either going to be rail or it's going to be pipelines. We know that industry is pursuing both. We know that the U.S. oil industry is moving oil by rail for a lot of it from North Dakota Bakken crude. But there was a projection made that there was going to be 200,000 barrels a day of tar sands that's going to move by rail if Keystone didn't move ahead. And guess what? Only 40,000 barrels a day are moving. What does that say to you? It says that it is not pipeline versus rail. Pipelines are cheaper. They're going to move it by pipeline. That's what pipeline companies, what the industry wants. Rail is going to be used for Bakken crude. It's going to be used for certain types of destinations, but it's not a destination that's an alternative to Keystone. And so we don't want the public to be misled into it's going to be either or. And so the pipeline fights are pushing things off into the rail.
Deutsch wouldn't support Keystone under any circumstance, she told the audience. But Dewar won't give any ground. Alberta's envoy to D.C., former MP Rob Merrifield, was in the audience on March 3rd, and he works every day inside the Beltway. As long as there's support for the pipeline and Merrifield and Dewar's advocacy anywhere in Washington, that Keystone debate is there to stay.
You're listening to McLean's on the Hill. So the first panel was in Washington, but we'll head back north of the border now. To mark International Women's Day, we hosted a panel at the University of Ottawa to discuss women in politics. Once again, we get the details from Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on McLean's.ca.
Anne McGrath, the NDP's national director, was a calming force when the Orange Wave carried her party into official opposition. Katie Telford, a Liberal campaign co-chair, is on the front lines of Justin Trudeau's quest for the Prime Minister's office. Michelle Austin, Suma Strategy's senior advisor, has spent more than two decades working in war rooms and winning campaigns. These women command the respect of the people who work around them, and McLean's senior writer Anne Kingston had 90 minutes this afternoon to ask them about the challenges they faced along the way and still expect to confront as they live and breathe politics. That panel discussion was part of a day-long look at women in politics hosted by the University of Ottawa's I Vote, Je Vote campaign. McLean's managing editor Susan Allen worked with the U of O's Kevin Page to organize the panel, and she joins us to talk about what three partisan powerhouses had to say.
So the discussion opened with a question about what specifically parties are doing to welcome women. Katie Telford highlighted a social media campaign in which people were invited to identify women they thought should run. Of the 400 names offered up, Telford says more than 65 became contestants within the open nomination contest. Anne McGrath spoke of a time not so long ago when women around campaigns stuffed envelopes and poured coffee.
Though McGrath did note now that they are working throughout the party, shaping both policy and debate.
So then Michelle Austin spoke on behalf of the Conservatives. Listen as she explains why the party does not have a program to recruit women.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me here, University of Ottawa, Samara and McLean's. Obviously, I'm the Conservative on the panel, and I know that universities generally love Conservative politicians, and most particularly myself, who grew up in the Reform Party. Conservatives at this point approach this issue a little bit differently. We believe that the best candidate is the best candidate. It should be based on merit. There is no particular program to recruit women. There's a program to recruit wonderful candidates. And frankly, we have an advantage because we are the government and we've been the government for a while, and people frankly also want to participate. So I look out in Kanata, where Gordon O'Connor is leaving, and there are four individuals who are vying for the nomination. One is a woman, one is an ethnic minority, and there are two other men who would fall probably in a middle-aged white man category. And good for them. I hope the best person wins, because they're all out there trying to get the nomination. And we see them not necessarily as women, not necessarily as minorities, but I think one of the conversations that has to be had here is that you need to see them as a winner, somebody who can go out and win the vote and win the nomination.
The conversation continued, but at first opportunity, Telford responded to Austin's suggestions that parties should forget about gender and focus on identifying winning candidates. Here's what she had to say.
I have to push back on, and I know Michelle was waiting for this. This idea that we need candidates who are winners and we need to only win based on merit, I agree. But that suggests that there aren't women who can do both of those things. Women are out there who can absolutely win contested nominations, who should be becoming the candidates across the country, but they're not necessarily, as Anne said earlier, feeling welcome or feeling like this is a profession that, for a whole host of reasons, practical, personal, historic, there's a whole host of reasons that women don't get involved. But when they do, they can absolutely be winners. And we have examples of that all over the place. One of the concerns the Liberal Party of Canada had, and that I certainly wrestled with, was when we came out with an open nomination policy, and when the leader, during his leadership campaign, came out with an open nomination policy, was what would that mean if we gave away that right to have that number of appointments? What would that mean for the party? Because oftentimes one of the ways of ensuring that there were more women running was to be able to appoint some of those women in some of those ridings. So we gave that away, and it was, you know, we just decided we're going to have to work harder in some of those places. We're going to have more encouragement, more training, more opportunities. And we have seen women winning, to my absolute thrill, contested nominations in all corners of the country. And I would actually say that those women are beating out some, in some cases, some extraordinarily experienced politically men. And so I really caution you on the language around it to suggest that by opening the door wider to women, we are somehow not allowing winners into Parliament.
The women discussed recruitment, the nomination process, systemic obstacles, and the climate on Parliament Hill.
And a little bit later, Anne Kingston noted that sometimes it seems as though we've been having the same conversations about women in politics for a long time. She asked the panelists how they would reframe the conversation.
So I did reframe it early, and you booed. No, you gave Katie the cheer, right? So Hillary Clinton actually is going through this, I think. The New York Times recently did an article on this, that she has stopped trying to demonstrate how good she is, and she now is trying to demonstrate what a nice human she is, right? And so it's a very interesting sort of different backlash. Yeah, I completely agree. We're stalled in terms of the percentage of representation, and we're stalled in terms of the conversation that we're having. But when you try and be disruptive and say, hey, I'm not a girl. I'm just somebody who's here for a cause. I'm somebody here who's here to represent my community. People tend to say, oh, no, but you're a woman, and we need to do things to accommodate you. And so, you know, it sort of falls on both sides. I think women candidates need to stop thinking of themselves as women candidates and need to start thinking of themselves as candidates and winners. And I think that the parties have to, and the media, tend to have to stop talking about, oh, you know, Ronna Ambrose has the most beautiful hair on Parliament Hill, or Michelle Rempel is the sexiest MP.
I know some men who get the hair comments sometimes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He has lovely hair.
So Anne McGrath agreed that change is not happening fast enough, though she did point out some progress.
One of the things that I found refreshing when we had the 2011 election and elected a large number of young people and women was the sense of, why can't we change this? Like, you know, like in Parliament in particular, there's always this really, in some ways, positive sense of tradition and culture, and this is the way we've always done things. But there is something incredibly refreshing about someone coming in and saying, but why? Like, why can't we do it this way? Why can't we, you know, why can't we have children in there? Why can't we, change the hours? Why can't we have electronic voting? All of those kinds of things. So I think some of those conversations are starting to happen, and I think they'll be very helpful.
Maclean's will have video and a transcript of the session on Maclean's.ca soon.
In the meantime, can we give the last word to McGrath and Telford?
In all the years that I've been doing this, I have actually never, ever had a man say to me, I can't run because I don't know enough about federal politics. And I hear that.
Do you think I'd be good at this?
I don't know enough about how the political party works. I don't know enough about Parliament. I don't know exactly. Never had that happen.
That was Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Maclean's.ca, and Maclean's managing editor, Susan Allen, walking us through the two forums this week, one in Washington to discuss the Keystone XL pipeline and the other in Ottawa to discuss women in politics. To check out more of our coverage of both events, go to Maclean's.ca.
Still to come on the show, we sit down with a former Reform Party leader, Preston Manning, to discuss the state of conservatism in Canada.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
For the seventh year, the Manning Networking Conference has brought Canada's Conservatives to Ottawa. It's become the main annual gathering of right-wingers to talk policy and politics. The confab is put on by the Calgary-based Manning Centre for Building Democracy, so it's not controlled by the Conservative Party.
But a few top Tory cabinet ministers always make an appearance, this year including Finance Minister Joe Oliver and Defence Minister Jason Kenney. Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes sat down with Preston Manning, the founder and president of the Manning Centre, and of course the former Reform Party leader, to talk about the state of conservatism in Canada.
Professor Manning, thanks a lot for talking about Clainstern.
Okay, thank you.
At your conference, seventh one, you were just telling me this is the seventh one. First general question about that. Is it possible in a nutshell to say how you've seen the conference evolve over the years? How does it differ now than what it was when you were setting out with this
thing? Well, we position it as a sort of a meeting of the conservative movement as distinct from the party. Like the party, there's party people here, but we say the movement includes the think tanks, the interest groups that are push market-oriented ideas, the training institutes, so the critics, students that are kicking tires, so it's kind of a broader thing. And it started with that idea, but very small, but it's grown now to 700, 800, 900 people that come, and from across the country. So we've been pleased with how it's evolved. It's really a get-together of the movement people.
We, as a journalist, it's always interesting for us because we get definitely a conservative perspective, but quite a wide-ranging conservative perspective here.
Yeah.
Do you find, as you become more of an established event on the Ottawa calendar, that there's pressure for you to avoid sensitive subjects or to take on certain subjects? Does that kind of come into play in organizing
the conference? Well, there's a bit of that, but it's not the same as a party convention. Where like a party convention, these no matter what party you're talking about, they're tightly controlled now because they're desperately afraid of some mistake, somebody going off on a tangent, or particularly if you're a governing party, something that's at variance with where the government, then you've got a big problem.
Yeah.
But this is a much more relaxed environment. We have different perspectives on the issues, and people will discuss them, but there's no vote, there's no resolution at the end. So I think it's a more relaxed, and therefore there's an opportunity to discuss the pros and the cons of different positions that you don't find at the tightly managed party conferences.
I want to ask you about two or three of the themes that seem to be represented here, but maybe I could start with energy and the environment, because I happen to catch both. You had a premier's panel, premier's panel that was focused around that, but I also heard an expert sort of discussion around market solutions to environmental problems, and we think of carbon tax, I guess, as being the, or carbon prices, as being the sort of headline one of that. What do you think about that issue? On the one hand, I would argue that the purest description of a conservative approach to policy that I ever hear at these things is people talking about the need for free market instruments to put a price on pollution. On the other hand, despite the fact that it seems like such a robust conservative position, it doesn't have a lot of traction with big parts of the conservative political movement in this country. Why does that dichotomy exist, do you think?
Well, I think it's something that has to develop. I use this argument that conservation and conservative has come from the same root, that living within your means, which is the heart of fiscal conservatism, is actually an ecological principle. We have to live within our means ecologically, so it's no big jump. And that conservatives profess to believe in markets, and therefore ought to prefer market-based approaches to dealing with pollution to massive government intervention. The way if people are hung up about carbon pricing or climate change, I said, then don't start there. Your conservative principle, start somewhere else. Start with garbage. Start with industrial and household waste. You can apply pricing mechanism, market mechanism. Start with water. Now, Southern Alberta, there's water shortages. Start with those.
But
don't throw out the whole concept that your market concepts actually can solve something. Don't throw it out because you're hung up on one application.
Right.
And we can kind of say that at this conference, where if you said it at a party conference, it would be seen as controversial, and it would just cause a headache for people.
I think it's because people equate putting a price on carbon with raising taxes, right? And there's a natural conservative version to anything that sounds like you're talking about raising taxes. It seems as simple as that.
That's a challenge. And then, of course, you can get into, can have offsetting taxes. If you don't want it to have an effect on people's bottom line, you can reduce some other tax in order to accommodate that price.
Right.
But I almost don't get into that. If I find someone's hung up on that, then say, okay, well, apply your conservative principles to some other form of environmental change, but don't abandon the whole field because of your apprehensions in this particular area.
Another policy area or a preoccupation of government that I associate with you is the idea of democratic reforms, government being more responsive to grassroots opinion. My impression around being around Parliament Hill here is that has waned in recent years, and one of the reasons, but not the only reason, is because Senate reform seems to have been just blocking it.
There's just a discouragement. The government, to be fair, put its democratic eggs in the Senate reform basket, and we can take some of the blame or the credit for that.
We hammered away on that
for years and for years. But then the court virtually made it impossible to go down that route, which is it took away the one major Democratic initiative that the government was committed to. So I think it's discouraging to Democratic conservatives that right. that was cut off, not by an action of the government so much, but by an action of the court.
Where should people redirect their energies now if they're interested in that side of politics?
Well, I think there's going to be a contest between to what extent do some of these court decisions end up being anti-democratic, and that is a good one. The public showed that we have polls to show a large number of Canadians want that institution reformed, and now they differ on what they mean by that, but they want that reform. The fact that the court has thrown a roadblock right in the front of that, that becomes a democratic challenge. Is the Supreme, when the Supreme Court is dictating democratic policy, is that really something that the court should be doing? I think it's going to show some more, put some more light on it, analyzing the role of the court.
We're not even at the midpoint of the conference yet, so I was curious about what sorts of things you're looking forward to seeing, what themes are really top of mind for you as you look at the rest of the weekend.
Well, our polling shows these economic issues at the top of the mind with the public, so that's why we've got so much emphasis on what does it mean to move forward on the economy, move forward on energy and the environment and the economy. But the other thing that our polling showed is this concern about security at home and abroad has come up on the
scale.
Yes, but quite significant. Significantly. So responding to that, we've got a number of speakers. We have an Islamic scholar from the U.S. who's going to talk about Islamic extremism. We have Martin Lee, the father of the democratic movement in Hong Kong, talking about the threat of Beijing's state-directed democracy versus citizen-directed democracy. And I think Jason Kenney, who's going to give the last address, one of his first as defense minister, is going to touch on the Ukrainian-Russian situation. So that that concern about security is certainly, it's getting a lot more attention here than, say, it would have 2 years ago.
Picking up on what you've just been saying, obviously you've always shown a great concern and sensitivity about the place of faith in the public square in Canada. Are you concerned by the way Islam is being depicted in some of the debates surrounding security and terrorism? How would you suggest that people should talk about the fact that obviously, some of these concerns do raise questions about radical Islam without, I guess, widening the rhetoric to the point where it's intimidating to people who are moderate and you know, great Canadian citizens who are Muslims.
My experience with dealing with extremism, whether it's within your own camp or political parties or on the religious side, is the best people to deal with it are the moderates of that same faith because they understand the extremists far better than someone from the outside.
Right.
So I think if that's going to be dealt with, it has to be dealt in the final analysis by the moderates within that community. And what others of us that are outside that community can do is support them and encourage them. And that's why I'm quite interested to hear what this Islamic scholar has to say on that, because he's a Muslim, he understands that community, but he himself is alarmed by the extremism.
Very interesting. Do you like getting back to Ottawa, Preston, or are you glad to be away
from here? No, I don't mind coming to Ottawa. I don't miss the question period or that part of it.
But the media, you miss the media.
Oh, yes, yes, okay. That's right. I knew I was groping for something.
Beautiful. Thanks for talking to McLean's. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with former Reform Party leader Preston Manning about the 7th annual Manning Networking Conference. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.